Welcome to another edition of Blue Republican Radio with me, Robin Kerner, the original Blue Republican, doing something very new, new for me anyway. This is the first Blue Republican episode where my guest has been sitting with me in my studio, by which, of course, I mean not a studio at all, but my dining room table, which doubles as the studio. This is all rather low budget here on Blue Republican Radio. That's kind of the story of the life of the Liberty Movement, I would say. And my guest is not just a guest. She's a good friend who I've had the pleasure of sharing the stage with to talk about liberty once or twice, and we'll have the pleasure of doing so again in the near future, but we might get to that. Her name is Chris Ann Hall. She is one of the just best educators in liberty in the United States. Absolutely. I'm a big Chris Ann Hall fan. Go to her website.
ChrisAnnHall.com.
ChrisAnnHall.com. The clue is in the name. So you can see what it is that Chris Ann does. She was, broadly speaking, and you correct me if I'm wrong here, but Chris Ann was a prosecuting attorney, right?
Prosecuting attorney, yes, for the state of Florida.
Yes, and then got it in her head that she could exercise her First Amendment rights when she...
Silly me.
Yeah, really, right? When she... In her free time.
Free time, yes.
And they didn't like that.
No, it wasn't so much that I was doing something on my free time, it was what I was doing.
And what were you doing?
I was teaching people about limited government.
Yeah.
Yeah. And they said, this is what they said, teaching limited government and working for the government at the same time is an ethical conflict of interest.
Wow. You know what? Let's just have a moment's silence to let that sink in for the Liberty listeners out there. Yeah. And therein lies our problem.
Yeah,
in
right.
one sentence, right?
Right.
Wow. Oh, goodness me. Yeah, so this is Chris Ann. And now Chris Ann goes around the country, and she's like one of the just busiest liberty fighters in the US. Goes around the country teaching classes on, and this is why I love her, this is kind of how we got excited together the very first time we met, on the genealogy of the Constitution, as she calls it, or, you know, that bit of American history or the history of American liberty that is also British or English. And, of course, that's something that I'm a bit of an amateur in that, but I've got very interested in the English history of liberty, you know, the Anglo tradition, since I got interested in the philosophy and the politics of liberty. But
you call yourself an amateur, Robin, and I've actually learned some things from you. I have modified my genealogy presentation based on what you taught me about the agreement in 1014 and Ethelred.
There you go. And I would see, if I'm not careful, I'm going to talk about that right now. But I know I don't need to do that. I know I don't need to do that because my listeners have probably heard me mention it. But you know what? I did write the article, The Thousand Years of Liberty. So
right.
If anyone wants to know about that, they can look for The Thousand Years of Liberty article on the Huffington Post and wherever else I put it, Ben's one. Or even better, you can get a Chris Ann Hall. Go to a Chris Ann Hall event.
Mm-hmm.
And let her tell you all about it as well. And you won't just get...
And you'll know about it through ChrisAnnHall.com. And the odds are very great that you'll find one. Because I don't know if you know this, Robin, but I taught 265 times in 22 states last year alone.
There you go. You see, I told you she was crazy. Well, I didn't, but she is. But she's
also
wonderful. She's crazy for liberty.
Crazy.
That's right. That's right. So Chris Ann is, she's wonderful. And, you know, I was going to say we need more like her, but there will only ever be one. So, yeah, good stuff. Well, Chris Ann, she came to my place, an hour or so ago, and we've just been shooting the breeze, as they say.
Yeah, I don't know if we can classify those conversations.
No, that's right. That's
shooting
right.
the breeze.
A little serious. We get pretty heavy.
Our level, shooting the breeze.
Yes,
you know,
that's right.
Conversations
that's right.
that we have.
Yeah, that's right. So, it's wonderful to have her here, and we're going to just have a chat for the next hour. And I wasn't sure what we would talk about, because there's so many things that we can. But I decided that I would just tell her and all of you out there, my listeners, about an interesting little topic, perhaps a little obscure, that I posted to the Blue Republican Facebook group earlier this morning. And it was inspired by an article that came out in the British press that the United Kingdom government, through the National Health Service, our system of socialized medicine, is now subsidizing couples, specifically in this article, lesbian couples, but I think that's really not the point, to basically purchased donated sperm. And as someone who cares about liberty, and like all of us, just, you know, has my own moral sense, this kind of brings out a little bit of a conservative streak in me. Because I can't think of anything better than getting paid $300 a shot, if you'll excuse the pun, to donate sperm. But my conscience wouldn't allow me to do it. And this isn't a holier-than-thou thing. This is just something in me tells me that there's an issue here. And so I wrote a post about it on Facebook that's got a few interesting responses. So here's the post. And I'm just interested to talk to Chris Ann about it, because I know she has a personal connection to this issue, as well as obviously being...
We'll have to clarify that.
Well, no, absolutely. Yes, yes, we will. Yes, yes. Nobody leave the show yet. Okay, right. Let me explain the post, and then I'll hand it immediately over to Chris Ann so she can clarify indeed. Qualify my last statement. Okay, so this was, as I say, this was an article about the subsidized purchase of donated sperm. And I wrote this: if I donate sperm, I am biologically a father. If I contract with another couple that they will raise my biological child, then that deal has an externality on a third party, that third party being the created child. Now, that externality may be negative, as determined by the child when, let's say, he or she becomes an adult. And that child is the only person who can indeed determine whether that externality is negative for him. So, for example, if he wanted to find his father and there's an emotional impact of the father, you know, not allowing himself to be found or getting involved in that in his child's life. Now, there are thousands of children who have no parents and need adopting. And if a couple adopts such a child, all things being equal, there is no negative externality there, because the adopted child is going to get a better life from the alternative, all things being equal, from the alternative he or she would have had without a child. Therefore, I suggested, or I feel, sperm donation is not a morally neutral act for the man who does it. Its moral upside can be met by adoption, and its moral downside may not be mitigatable except by the father's participation in the child's life, which, for the purposes of this question, he refuses to do. Now, it seems to me, if you're interested in liberty and rights, and in this case you have an interest in, and indeed, you know, I guess even the free market and contracts and what is a voluntary exchange, a voluntary exchange shouldn't affect a third party without consent. There's a lot of issues here I think that liberty folks could get their teeth into. But when I posted that concern, I think a lot of people thought I was very strange, maybe having a weird conservative moment, and couldn't understand what I was getting at. But, you know, just again to clarify, I think it is the lack of knowledge of the situation that the father is creating for the child that puts a moral burden on him. So it's kind of like an epistemic thing. So go ahead, Chris Ann. You're so great on these kind of issues, and I'm just interested what you... please clarify what I said earlier. Then let's just talk about it.
The reason that I have a personal interest in this is because I am a woman who is physically incapable of having children. So this is an issue that is technically something that I've talked or I've considered or contemplated or even thought about. I think the first thing that I would like to bring up, and I know that you and I both agree on this, this is a moral issue, and therefore the government should not be involved in it at all. Mm-hmm. The government should not be subsidizing the creation of life any more than the government should be subsidizing the termination of life. And we're not going to get into those big discussions, because that's just a big can of worms that you can't finish in one radio show. But nonetheless, so I'm totally against this whole thing from the get-go, simply from a government
right.
intrusion on a moral decision.
Right. But we're going to take the government out of it then, I think.
Yes. For the sake of this argument now, we're going to take the government out of this. And the way that I would approach this may be somewhat different than what someone else would approach. I am a deeply spiritually guided person. I could have in vitro fertilization or something. Probably not for me, but I could have a surrogate.
Mm-hmm.
I could do lots of things biologically to enhance my ability or to change my inabilities to have a child. But for me, I don't believe that it's my choice. I believe that the role that I have to play in this whole thing is my relationship with God. And so praying and engaging in sometimes very emotional supplication is the key to this issue.
Okay. This is set up for interesting discussion. We're going into the break. Welcome back to Blue Republican Radio, and I interrupted Chris Ann just as she was getting going. So, Chris Ann, you just carry right on, please.
Well, first off, we'll remind everybody this is an issue based on morality and not on government, so they got no business in it. But it's a complex issue, really. And I think maybe you realize that by the comments that you got back, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, what do you do? You're parents who cannot have children. What are your options? And it's a moral issue. Now, you had asked me, how do you feel about that? Well, that's different how I feel about it and how I would impose those feelings on someone else. For me, it's a spiritual issue. It's a relationship issue. Biblically speaking, 1 Samuel, I can't remember, 1 Samuel, whatever, Hannah is in the same situation that I'm in. She cannot have children. But in Hannah's day, there is no way to, you know, engage in $300 a shot to have a baby or whatever, right? So for her, she submits her problem to God and trusts God to provide the solution. Whether it may be, because faith is a matter of trusting the yeses and the noes. And walking and living by faith means that you have to believe that what God has for you is the ultimate good thing, and, you know, otherwise, whatever. And so, for me, a consideration, and I will admit to you, 5 years of praying for a child made me think about a lot of things. Made me think about, you know, well, what about these artificial methods? What about this biological, scientific option? So in the interim, I'm contemplating that, but it always came back to, who am I relying on? And who will be the provider of this need? And so, again, biblically speaking, I go to Hannah, who cried out to God because she couldn't have children, and God blessed her for her faithfulness and for her trusting in him to do that. But biblically speaking, Abraham and his wife were not having a child. God said, I will give you a child. They got impatient, and Abraham slept with the maid and made a baby, which was a huge mistake. What they did was they took their need and their desire into their own hands, failed to trust God for the better solution, and ended up with a huge family disaster. So for me, morally speaking, that was it. Do I stop waiting and stop trusting and take matters into my own hands, or do I wait it out? Whether the yes be a yes or a no be a no. And for me, it was always a question of my obedience and trusting God's faithfulness.
What, just so I'm clear, Do you believe, or would you say that the use of science is necessarily at odds? I mean, the science that comes out of the God's creation. There's nothing, you know. What we have developed as a human race cannot be mutually exclusive with God's laws and God's creation. So, does the argument or the perspective you've just given, would that stop you going to use these biological methods? It's not clear to me that they contradict each other, that they're at odds with each other. Do you see what I'm saying?
Right, no, I understand. And again, it's a matter of would I? And I would say no, because it did stop me. I did not go to these things. So I didn't invest in those things because I believed that the greater reward was waiting for what God had for my family.
But I guess what I'm asking is, why did you feel that God did not want you to go and get on with it using the other means, let's say less typical means, that he has made available to you through science or through medicine or whatever?
Well, now that's a very good question. And the answer is a spiritual one. I can't explain it.
So this was your feeling?
Yes.
Yes, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
I never, as I prayed to have a child.
Mm-hmm.
And remember, I'm contemplating these other methods. I never had peace about it.
Okay.
I always related those other options to what Abraham and Sarah did with the maid,
okay.
Right? And so for me, it felt like disobedience.
Okay.
And so for me, obedience and trusting God is the most important thing that I can do as a Christian.
Okay.
Now, would I condemn someone else for making that decision? Well, of course not, because I believe that God gives people wisdom and has developed the wisdom and the science to help us deal with a lot of issues
mm-hmm.
that, you know, we didn't have. So I can give God credit for that as well.
Mm-hmm.
But we're...
Okay.
But again, it's a moral issue.
Okay. So what about... Now, bearing in mind that I'm guessing most of my listeners don't share your religious convictions. So how do we approach this as a moral issue, my concerns, without starting from biblical ground? What do you think of of my moral concern that comes out of the responsibility, the natural, let's say for some people who aren't God, they might say it's a natural responsibility that the father has for the biological child that he creates?
Can I pick a different perspective?
Please.
I mean, a different moral perspective from your writing.
Okay.
I would be morally opposed to the whole thing of the, you know, donations and sperms and that because of a very important issue that you brought up. We have so many children that need to be adopted. And even so, we have so many parents who want to adopt that they're going to foreign countries to do it.
Mm.
And so my moral basis would be we should be pushing adoption.
Yes.
Because this idea of, and for me, again, this sperm donating and egg donating and all that is a very selfish perspective. It's, I don't want to adopt a child because I want a child to be part of me, right? I want to be able to pick the dynamics of my child because, you know, I'm going to go to the sperm donor bank. They're going to tell me these traits of my child. I don't want to take a child that may not be exactly what I want. And so it is a very selfish, self-centered perspective.
But would you, I mean, that's a strong claim in as much as I think many parents, especially mothers, would say, but that feeling of wanting to make what is of me is at the core of wanting to become a mother. It's part of the maternal urge for so many people if you actually speak to them about it.
You know, but I think that's a perspective that comes from lack of knowledge.
Okay.
And I do believe that it's self-centered. I still believe it's self-centered. Because regardless of what that natural urge is, it's a selfish natural urge.
The fact that it concerns the self, does that make it morally bad, though? There is such thing as, in, you might say, you know, enlightened self-interest.
Well, The morality of the issue is, are we at a position where there is no better
option? Right, which was the kind of the point in my post.
Right, exactly.
Yes, yeah.
So if we lived in a country where people were competing for adoptions because there were so few of them, and there were no children without homes, then perhaps fabricating them in a laboratory would be different.
Mm-hmm.
But the moral perspective is, I need, from a parent should be this, I will sacrifice that self of me for a child. And for me, the moral aspect of this, this donation and that sort of thing, says I will not sacrifice me for the child.
Okay. Well, we're going into the break, and I you've given me a lot of questions, and I hope I remember them by the time we come back. Back to Blue Republican Radio. This isn't like any other interview I've ever done. I'm loving it. Okay, so, Chris-Anne, just thinking about what you just said as we went into the break, I think that there's a sense in which having a child at some level is necessarily selfish, but on the other hand, it's kind of what makes the world go round, and it's what, in a very deep sense, some would say we are meant to do. Why should parents who want to have a child but cannot biologically easily have one be held to a higher standard, as it were, than those who may selfishly want to make a child in the normal fashion, who are perfectly able to, when they also could adopt? I mean, it does seem like it's not the same standard for, do you see what I mean, for both kinds of parents?
Oh, no, I am entirely pro-adoption. So I believe parents who can have the ability to create children should also be adopting, just because it's a crisis in our country.
But you wouldn't say it's morally inferior to make a child in the normal fashion?
Oh, absolutely not.
But it does seem like that's where your argument leads with respect to those who are biologically unable to.
Well, I don't think that I understand that so question.
Because you're saying that there's a problem if you choose to go to a sperm bank, let's say. And the problem being that they're adoptive, children that need adopting. So that's kind of morally higher. However, you can make the same argument for parents that might want their own children who can just do it in their own bed.
Well, let me remind you that the argument was yours first.
I'm very aware of that.
Okay, so
I'm very aware of that.
But and I don't know.
But, yes, but see, and I will answer that, actually,
right.
Yes. Yeah.
So the point that I'm making is for me, personally, it's a moral, there is a moral level there.
Mm-hmm.
But I would not impose that moral level
on
someone else.
Yeah.
Because for me, the way I operate, and the question was, how would you operate? I would operate based on my relationship with God.
Yes.
And I want to let people know that I would have just been as happy if God had said no as to what he actually did. You know, we ended up adopting a child.
Mm-hmm.
And we trusted God to provide for that. We never even went to an adoption agency.
Mm.
All we did was pray. And pray very fervently, I might add, because it was something that was very heavy on my heart.
Mm-hmm.
And being at church one day, nobody knowing that I'm praying for a child, a woman comes, we were discussing as we were cleaning the kitchen, one of my friends says, I got a call from somebody right out of the blue who I haven't talked to her in months, and she says her daughter is going to have a child and they need to find a home for this child because they can't keep the child. Do you know anyone who wants to adopt a child? And so for me, the exercise of faith was had proven God's faithfulness to that relationship that we have together. So for me, it is an exercise of faith. Mm. And anything else would not work. And the, you know, the, for me, the selfish nature, for me, the selfish nature of, you know, creating a child rather than trusting God to deliver one is simply based on, I think, and it was something that you brought up, I wanted to be part of me. And I think what that really boils down to is a misunderstanding about a relationship between an adopted child and an adoptive parent. I think people who have never adopted think that you can't love an adopted child as much as you would love a child of your own. You can't love, it's a different love. It's not as deep as with the child comes from your womb as this adoption. And granted, I've never known the from the womb option, but I cannot imagine loving any being more than my son.
I actually have met one or two other adopted parents and I who have said exactly the same thing, and I don't doubt that for a moment. It's interesting. I mean, I don't think that's where the concern about adoption comes, people who don't want to adopt. I think it really is this basic, I want to create a part of me. I want the part of me that's going to carry on. I mean, and for me...
I can see that.
Yeah, and so I mean, which, you know, and the, so the... For me, the issue kind of hinges on, you know, it's different to create a baby versus, you know, in one's own bed in the normal, natural way. If you know, you as the father are going to be there to do the best by the child, right? So the issue of, you know, could the child grow up, be seeking a father that then refuses to participate in that child's life, and that gives the child some negative externality, that issue doesn't arise in the case of a natural conception and birth. Do you see what I mean? So that's the distinction.
But it does arise with adoption.
No, but I'm saying if we're comparing adoption versus two parents naturally making a baby versus adoption versus going to a sperm donor.
Right, but the sperm donor and the adoption do have the same dynamic. But because the child may legally never be able to know who their biological parents are.
No. Right. But again, so then you come to the fact that there's negative externality in the sense that with the sperm donor and the moral burden on the father, that once you've got a situation that the child is already exists, this is why it's different, right? The child already exists.
Right.
And it, you know, you're definitely giving that child a better life.
Mm-hmm.
The option to know the father... if you like, that's already failed. Whereas if I go to a sperm bank and I do this for $300, I know I'm intentionally putting a child in that position, which seems to me to be justifiable only if I believe a priori I have no moral responsibility toward an offspring, a biological offspring. And I'm uncomfortable with that. I think there's a kind of a natural responsibility.
Well, and I think that argument could be made in the adoption perspective as well. Not on the side of the people who are adopting the child, but the side of the people who created the child. A large number of children are up for adoption because of that very mentality. We're going to have our, you know, time of fun and the consequences be damned. And so now we've created a life and I'm out of the picture now. Thanks very much. And so it is a lack of morality.
But it may be circumstance. I mean, you know,
right.
It may be circumstance. I mean, you know, right.
Statistically speaking, not very likely.
Okay.
But nonetheless, you still have at least one person who is involved in this, who is being irresponsible about this creation of life.
Right. Okay. So now, what is your take on, what do you think is the moral position of a man donating sperm? Answer that with reference to the fact that there may be a woman who cannot have a child only because of the husband's inability to have a child. What then? Does that mean to be able to deal with that situation, does that make the act of a sperm donating man a moral?
Well, how about I make this complicated?
Oh, isn't it complicated enough?
Yeah, all right. Okay. Because morality has to do with your personal perspective.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So if I'm a man... and I just want $300, and this is an easy way to make $300, and so what? I would think, yes, that's an immoral act. But if I go into that thinking I have a gift that I can give to somebody who cannot have this on their own, then morally speaking, because this is an internal perspective, morally speaking, then there's a difference, isn't there?
There is, except for the fact that I think, you know, you say in the story that you told, you didn't go to an anonymous place.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't the donation of the sperm is not necessary for a parent, a mother who can't have a son or daughter by the husband, to be able to do that, because that parent can go and actually meet people, know people, and invite people to do that for her. It doesn't have to be anonymized. It doesn't have to depend on a contracted refusal of participation, where I, as the father, will not have any idea of the quality of the people as parents who will be using my sperm.
So there's
a question there that I don't think it can be avoided.
Right. So I was going to argue with you about that for at the beginning, but now I understand the perspective is not the childless parents wanting to engage in that service, but the man wanting to just have hands off on the whole situation. And so if he's really wanting to give this gift, then he has a moral responsibility to ensure that at least in his conscience at the time of the donation, that the people that are going to be getting this will be raising their child well.
That's kind of my instinctive position.
Yeah, okay, all right.
And I don't know that that's right, but it feels like it feels like a serious issue to me.
Well, because it's a moral issue.
Yeah, indeed.
And which is why, by the very nature of it, the government shouldn't be involved in it.
Well, that's, yes, we agree on
and
that.
And so morality is about operating according to the dictates of your conscience. Morality and the ability to operate under the dictates of your own conscience is a fundamental aspect of liberty.
Yes, absolutely. You know, this is interesting. We've probably got the best part of 10 minutes still left in this segment. So let's just move this a little bit over in the light of what that recent decision from the Supreme Court. Because if you socialize medicine, as with so many other things, this is, you know, I don't make a kind of a typical libertarian attack, you know, we've heard it 100 times before, but the fact that you have the state influencing decisions like this is an inevitable outcome over time of socializing, health and these huge.
Oh, it's only going to get worse.
And indeed. Yes. And so I, you know, if I was still living in Britain, I would have to watch, obviously, if I had a big problem with something like that the National Health Service was doing, my tax dollars would go to it. Some people understandably object to the funding of abortion through state, but we don't have to talk about that. You know, it's the same kind of offense against conscience in these areas, you know, happen more and more the more you socialize these areas of life, which so libertarians, people who love liberty, are rightly concerned about. The Hobby Lobby decision was interesting to me because I know there's a lot of pieces to this, and I know you've written about this. If you read the media. Well, indeed, it was a decision. I mean, I believe if you actually read the decisions, you know, the discussion of religious freedom is explicit. But it seems to me that the offense against liberty is more fundamental than one that you need invoke religious freedom to explain, because I don't need to have a religion. Mm-hmm. To have my conscience offended by being forced as a third party to pay to get subsidized person or pay for something for person A delivered by organization B that I just wouldn't choose to do. I don't need a religion to see that's, you know, religion doesn't have to be invoked to see that's a problem, right?
Okay, well, see, I think what we're, and this is what happens when we sort of generalize the Bill of Rights into one term, right? Freedom of religion.
Yeah.
That's not what this is about.
Yes.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Congress shall make no law establishing a religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Okay? If Congress cannot establish a religion, if the government cannot establish a religion, which means they can't say that's a religion, But they cannot say that's not a religion either.
Very
and so
point.
This classification that we have,
yes.
this box of religion, is simply very archaic when yeah. we think about
it. It's almost a self-defeating definition.
It is, absolutely is, because it's, I like the way our framers said it, that man must be left to worship according to the dictates of his conscience.
Right.
Which means if his conscience doesn't demand him to worship, then he has that liberty to not worship. If his conscience dictates him to worship the tree, then he has the liberty to worship the tree. And it's because our framers knew that when government gets involved in dictating conscience, then there is no liberty.
And the point I think I want to make is that there is no way that you can have a system where the state forces party A to pay for something for party B from party C and not be forcing conscience.
Well, let me tell you what. Thomas Jefferson said, to force people to pay through the collection of taxes for things that they do not believe in is sinful and tyrannical.
Now, that, at first blush, would take down every modern state.
Because we have drifted so far from the understanding of liberty. And can I blow your mind just for a minute?
Blow my mind. This is why I have you here, Cassandra. Blow our minds.
Do you know what the chief culprit of all this mess that we're dealing with is? This crazy grasp that we have in this country and this need to call America a Christian nation. We are not a Christian nation. We are a nation built on a Judeo-Christian worldview. There's a difference. And because we run around out of ignorance and say, well, we're America's a Christian nation, that changes how we think about things. And so when we think about religion, we think about Christianity. And we think about morality, we think about Christianity. And that is not the principles under which our country was built. Our principles our country was built under was a Judeo-Christian worldview that teaches that there is liberty to choose. The fundamental aspect of this Judeo-Christian worldview was best described by a man named John Leland, who was the head of the political party in Virginia called the Virginia Baptist General Convention. And he said, and I'm trying to pull this out of my brain now, he said, every man must give himself to account to God. Therefore, every man should be at liberty to choose how he worships God according to his conscience. If government can stand before God on that day of judgment, let men be dictated by government. But if not, then men must stand alone. Because it's that understanding. The Judeo-Christian worldview teaches that every man will stand, regardless of what you believed on this earth, you will stand before God and God will deal with you individually. Therefore, it's not the right of other men to dictate to you your moral perspective. Because that's an issue between you and God, and you have individual
Rinse the break. Thank you, Kazan. I just love hanging out with Chrisanne. Chrisanne, thanks for spending this time with me. I really enjoyed this show. So, and I'm really delighted, and I want to just tell the listeners that you and I will be doing an event together with Mark Herr, another recent interviewee on this show, in Spokane, Washington, right? The last last weekend of August.
Last weekend of August.
Yeah, and that's going to be
Liberty Fusion.
Love it. That and it's going to be a show. This isn't going to be just like, listening to a few people give lectures. Mark and Chrisanne and I discovered that we kind of spark off each other a bit. And I'm really excited because I think Well, I know it's going to be great. We kind of accidentally discovered that we worked well together in Sacramento not long ago, and it turned into Liberty Fusion, this show. So check that out, Spokane, last weekend of August. And then in Minnesota, Minneapolis, on the 7th of September, so I think just a week later, we are going to be discussing the Constitution and its relationship to political conflict.
That's awesome. You know, and if just go to my website, chrisannhall.com. I have an events calendar if they want to know details about that. And I don't know if you have an events calendar too, but they can reach that stuff. It's already up there on there. And it's if you enjoy the way Robin and I interact on the radio like this, imagine that with a three-way.
Yeah, you ain't seen nothing yet.
It's going to be a three-way, a Liberty three-way.
Liberty three-way. I love it, Liberty three-way. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. And actually, I should say about the Minnesota one, bluerepublican.org, that one you have to get tickets for that at $17.76. And you can just, if you donate
$17.76. How cool is that?
Blue Republican.
You guys are so cool.
Yeah, clever like that. Clever like that. So, yeah, and it's going to be worth it. I mean, I tell you, it's going to be worth it.
It's going to be brilliant.
It's going to be not only worth it, but brilliant.
Brilliant.
Not least because Chris Ann Hall will be there. And seriously, check out her stuff. I mean, I love her to death, but, you know, she has these great DVDs and great material and puts out a lot of good stuff. Actual, like, real action items based on the history of our Constitution.
I have a brand
Liberty
new book
world.
Coming out, too.
Quickly, tell us in the last 10 seconds.
It's called Sovereign Duty. And it is the solution, the plan our framers gave us to fix this federal problem.
We do not have to reinvent the wheel of liberty. They've invented it over 1,000 years, and it's just fine.
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
God bless.